Joseph Andrews by Henry Fielding, dramatised in 4 episodes by John Scotney, with June Barry, Cornelius Garrett and John Rye.
The second part, being very full of adventures, some scarce credible to those who have never travelled in a stagecoach. In every trade, from the highest to the lowest, from prime ministering down to this of authoring, there are certain mysteries or secrets. Among those we poor scribblers use, there is one vulgarly called keeping you in the dark. Just as we say a simple fellow is easily seen through, so too a simple tale may be easily seen through. But not this present history, be assured. Here we open our scene, but by small degrees, and much is kept concealed.
Thus, did you wonder that Joseph did not this night proceed to his native village or to his dear sister Pamela, but rather set out full speed to Booby Hall in Somersetshire?
Country seat of the Lady Booby, from whose service he had just been so ignominiously dismissed.
You may have wondered indeed, but I dare venture you did not guess the reason.
Be it known, then, that in the parish where Booby Hall stood
lived a poor girl 2 years younger than Joseph.
She had been dismissed from Lady Booby's service by Mrs. Slipslop, my lady's waiting gentlewoman, on account of her extreme beauty, or so it would seem, for I could discover no other reason.
And now lived with the family of a farmer in the parish. Her name was Fanny Goodwill.
She was beloved of Joseph. Oh, Fanny.
She returned his affection. Oh, Joseph.
Dear Fanny, let me gather you in my arms in a chaste but passionate embrace.
Oh, beloved Joseph, though my modesty will not suffer me to allow you any other attentions, yet my violent love for you makes me welcome your eager kisses with a passion equal to your own. Joseph!
Oh, Fanny, were it not for Parson Adams' excellent advice, I might... Oh, Fanny!
Nothing can be imagined more tender than was the parting between these rustic lovers when Joseph had perforce to accompany Lady Booby to London. Their parting was all the more affecting in that, such are the busy labours of a great house, Joseph could not be spared his duties, and they had to meet in the kitchens of Booby Hall.
Oh, Fanny, dearest. 1,000 sighs heave in my bosom at the thought of leaving you. Sorry.
Mother cares, Joseph, Fanny. I'll just be setting down this hot pudding. Don't let I be disturbing you.
1,000 tears distill from my eyes at that same prospect, dear Joseph.
I will, without fail, write to you every week, dear Fanny.
Oh, no. Joseph, no, since that I can neither read nor write, another would have to read your letters to me, and so become privy to your dear thoughts. Oh, what is it?
This giblet pie. How do I tell if it's ready, Fanny?
Put down the crust, you fool. I've let my buzzers down. And these they two along together, yeah?
Nor will I communicate with you, Joseph, for I could not transmit the delicacies of my chaste and tender passion by the hand of an Emmanuel.
Yeah, the spit's made a green mark.
But then wipe it with your snot rag. Use your knife and come away.
Oh, then, Fanny, we must content ourselves with frequent inquiries as to each other's health.
Confident of our future happiness.
But enough of this. Having explained these matters, and I hope satisfied any doubts concerning Joseph, let us set our hero back where we left him, hastening along the western road by the light of the October moon, and now singing to himself.
Come and assist me this very moment, for to pass away some time.
And so we commence, in good earnest, the second part of our Adventures of Joseph Andrews and His Friend Mr. Abraham Adams by your servant, Henry Fielding, gentlemen. Since, as is well known, love hath wings, it will come as no surprise that by 2 o'clock at night... By 2 o'clock at night, Joseph had travelled some 20 or 25 miles and found himself walking along a narrow lane deep in the country when a violent storm of rain commenced.
Fixed in your breath, your bones are distant, maybe a distance from my mind her lungs.
Stand and deliver!
Hello? Is there someone there?
Stand and deliver! He said, stand and deliver!
What did you say? I can't hear you in the rain. Can I be of some assistance, you gentlemen?
You could say that.
Oh, I see.
Now, stand and deliver, or you're a dead man.
Look, could we go over
under
that tree?
It'll be drier. Come on, then. Oh. Keep your cover, Jake. Now then, hand over your... hand over your body. Hand over, or else...
Very well. Here you are.
Ten. 12 poxy shillings and a tester, huh? Steph, you're lying. I don't believe that's all you have. We'll soon find out. Strip off that livery.
That I will not. It was lent me by a kind friend, and I've...
Strip, or I'll blow your brakes to the devil.
Never.
Then be damned to you. Oh, damn. Oh, fox, take it. What the devil's up with the pistol, Jake?
I do believe the powder's wet.
Do you, so you dabbing? Then we'll evict your mind. Damn your eyes, boys, as bad. Tackle him, Jake.
Right. Oh, would you?
Young Joseph was expert at cudgel play, and bringing up his own stick, soon had the advantage over his adversary, who, with a mighty blow, he laid sprawling at his feet.
Oh!
Oh, my dear sir, I trust you're not too badly hurt.
Hurt, you say? You swing for this young fellow. You've done for him.
On my soul, I hope not.
Joseph bent down to succor the prostrate Highlandman. His companion, seeing his opportunity and despairing of striking fire in his pistol, reversed it and struck Joseph from behind with the butt.
Jake, wake up, you poxy tom fool. Jake!
Oh, I'm blood in my head. Quick, finish him before he finishes us.
Yeah, he's laid. Now get up. I'll strip him. You search his clothes.
Nothing.
Eh?
No.
Eh?
No, not a spanker. Hardly worth the trouble of killing him.
Might as well take the livery, though. I have a use for that in mind. Yeah, give his aid. Good looking fella, wasn't he?
And so Joseph was thrown naked into a ditch and left for dead by the roadside. We say left for dead, for we are not of that callous and dishonest school of authors who, having adfixed a hero's name to their work, thereafter destroy him before their tale is a third part told. No, let Joseph's friends be comforted. The highwayman had but imagined they had put an end to him. We are, however, also conscious that our public will be anxious not only for our hero, but for our heroine, Lady Booby.
Lady Booby's passion for Joseph had, in truth, not ended with his dismissal. Confused, horrid dreams were her portion that night, and so restless and interrupted were her slumbers that she summoned Mrs. Slipslop to her chamber and tried to while away the dreary hours with a party of piquet. There, foolish woman! See for yourself, I have carte blanche. Oh, Slipslop, I am out of all patience with you. You understand nothing of the laws of piquet.
Nothing? Eh, nonny? I fear madame is somewhat distracted. For carte blanche, madame must have no court card, and your C is the ace of hearts. See?
Imbecile, in piquet the ace is no court card. It is the lowest of the pack. Yet, sometimes the lowest can o'ermaster the greatest. In a party of cards, I mean. Now, pray give me the pack. I believe I have now the younger hand. You are familiar with the expression, Slipslop? In piquet, the younger hand
means... That's some notification, madam, though I'm sure you have more dealings with younger hands than I. In PK, I mean.
Thank you. Tell me, Slipsop, that fellow I dismissed yesterday. Cut the cards, will you? I have forgot his name.
Young Andrews, madam.
The same. He has been turned away, according to my orders.
Oh, yes, madam. At your particular command. Four cards, madam.
One card. No doubt but that he slandered me for turning him out.
Oh, indeed, no, madam. When I informed him your ladyship would not give him a character, he sighed and said he had done nothing willingly to offend. And he prayed God to bless you, for he said you was the best of ladies. Point of five, madam.
Did he so? A point of five, you said. Not good. How came you, Slipslop, then, to advise me to turn Andrews away?
I, madam? Pray do me the honorarium, madam, to admit I did all in my power to prevaricate it.
And was it not you, audacious wretch, who made me angry with your tittle-tattle?
My what?
Yes. Your tittle-tattle, in which I believe you belied the poor fellow. You deliberately turned me against him.
I, madam.
You slip-slop.
I, madam.
You slip-slop. Poor fellow. Poor, poor fellow. You have done him much mischief, I fear.
Oh,
I see the reason of your whole behaviour now, as well as your complaint. You was jealous of the wenches he seduced.
I jealous, my lady? I assure you, madam, I look upon myself as his betters. I am not meet for a footman, I hope.
Not meet for... What mean you? What mean you? Are you... Are you implying... Are you... I assure you, he... God, zoned, get out! Out of prison, you hussy! Out!
With pleasure! Good night, madam, and pleasant dreams!
Joseph. Dear God, a footman! To expose myself to the refusal of a footman, I... Oh, Joey.
At last, as Aurora began to show her blooming cheeks, and across the land 10 millions of feathered songsters burst into jocund chorus, Lady Booby's troubled heart fell into... Well, in plain language, it was dawn before she got to sleep.
Oh, Joseph.
At much the same time, the public stagecoach from Exeter was between Basingstoke and Staines on its journey to London.
The morning was cursed wet and bitter cold.
Go on, turn ye! Get on, ye varmint!
What's that? What's that there?
Why have we stopped? Why are you getting down?
I think there's a dead man lying in the ditch, sir.
Oh, why do you say that?
I heard him groan, madam.
Drive on, sirrah. We are confounded late already. We have no time to look after dead men. Come, man, it's devilish cold.
Oh, sir, shame on you. Coachman, in Christian charity, go over and see what is the matter with him.
Yes, madam, I am.
What is it?
Is he dead? Oh, Lord, have mercy.
No, no, he seems to be breathing. And he's saving your presence, madam. He's as naked as ever he was born.
Oh, dear Jesus, a naked man. Dear coachman, leave him and drive on at once.
Would that we might, madam, and had you taken my advice, all would have been well, but now...
How so, sir?
I have some knowledge of the law, madam, and be assured, if he should die and we might be proved to have been lost in his company...
Yes?
In law, we could be called to some account for his murder.
Oh? Oh, what is it, coachman, with a naked man?
Is that you?
He's coming home, madam.
Oh, no, no, don't get up.
No.
No,
I must.
No. I must get to my beloved Fanny.
Oh.
Fanny!
Oh. 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 Oh.
Oh. Oh, wait. Wait, now I recall. I was attacked and robbed.
Sir, conceal yourself in the ditch again, I beg you. There is a lady in the coach.
Oh, Robert.
Look at yourself, fella.
Oh, merciful heavens.
What does the naked man say, coachman?
He says he was attacked and robbed, madam.
Robbed, coachman? Hasten back at once, you fool! Let us away immediately, lest we too are robbed! Quickly!
No, no! We must not abandon the poor fellow. You have convinced me of your opinion. We must do nothing to put ourselves outside the law. Coachman, bring the naked man into the coach... We must carry him to the nearest inn.
The nearest inn? That's the Dragon. That's 4 miles. That's a shilling. Who's going to pay for that?
Hawks, take the wretch. I am myself alighting at the Dragon and am well acquainted with the landlord. Will you carry him for a dram and a mug of beer when we arrive?
Oh, very well, then I will. I was always too compassionate for my own good. Come on, young fella. Into the coach with you.
You say there's a lady in the coach. I cannot confront her in this state.
It was not easy to get over this difficulty. The coachman had several greatcoats, but refused to lend them lest they get bloody. And the lady refused to allow her footman to lend one on the same grounds.
But my duty to Christian charity has quite overcome my modest reticence. Pray, bring him in as he is. I will avert my eyes as... Best I may.
Charity begins at home,
the gentleman remarked, wittily, and protested that he was cold himself and could not spare a rag. Indeed, it is probable that Joseph, by obstinately adhering to his modest resolution, would have perished. But our history was saved from such an abrupt and melancholy termination by the postillion, a lad since transported for robbing a hen roost.
He voluntarily stripped off his greatcoat, his only substantial garment, and, swearing a great oath...
For which he was rebuked by the lady.
...remarked that he would rather ride in his shirt all his life than suffer a fellow creature to lie in so miserable a condition.
And so Joseph, having put on the greatcoat, was lifted into the coach by the coachman, who returned to his box, and the journey was continued. Up now, up! Come on now!
The while, in her soft but lonely bed, Lady Booby slept. Her dreams were less troubled now, and her fancy painted her a more delicious scene. Yet it was but to delude, not to delight her.
Who is there? Who is it comes to my bedchamber?
It is I. Joseph, my lady.
Oh.
Such was my consuming passion for your beauty that I could not live away from you and have hastened back to your arms.
That was very wrong of you, but you are forgiven. Come hither, Joseph.
I come, O adorable fair one.
Her imagination being all on fire with the phantom, Lady Booby rose to meet it.
Come. Oh, come to me, you divine creature.
My lady.
Like a bubble bursting, her promised happiness vanished as she started from her sleep, waking to curse, not bless the vision.
Reflection made her pause. She blamed, then cursed the hasty rashness of her temper. The fault is mine, all mine. Joseph is innocent. I shall recall him. I shall so instruct Slipslop this very morning.
But then pride began to drive all softer passions from her soul and represented to her the meanness of Joseph's station.
Contempt succeeded next and began to obscure Joseph's beauties.
Then came disdain, bringing hatred of the creature who had given her so much uneasiness.
These enemies of Joseph had no sooner taken possession of her mind than they insinuated to her a thousand things in his disfavor, everything, that is, but the possibility that he should dislike her person.
That thought she checked the moment it endeavored to arise.
Revenge now came to her assistance.
She considered her dismission of him without a character with the utmost pleasure. She rioted in the several kinds of misery which her imagination suggested might be his fate. Ah.
And so comforting were these thoughts that she presently relapsed into sleep. As for the object of her various passions, Joseph was, in truth, in scarcely better case than her malice imagined.
Oh, you poor fellow. You look quite frozen.
I'm almost dead with cold, madam.
Oh, that is indeed understandable.
Ah, madam, you betray your ignorance of surgery. You are cold, you say, young fellow?
Yes, sir.
That is grievously symptomatic. Here, let me examine that head wound.
Are you a surgeon, sir?
I have some skill and knowledge in that science.
I thought you were a man of the law.
I am that also, madam. The parish where I live and at which we will soon arrive is somewhat small. I am both surgeon and physician there. And there being no lawyer in the parish, I have also interested myself in the law. Indeed, I never travel without Mr. Jacob's tables, and I dare say that... This is serious.
Oh, what is it?
The contusion on the head has perforated the internal membrane of the occiput.
Is that why I'm so cold, sir?
It is. The divalication of the minute invisible nerve which coheres to the pericranium is attended by a cold fever, now symptomatic, that will soon become pneumatic.
Is that serious too, sir?
I fear your case is that of a dead man, sure as a gun.
Dead? Oh, poor Fanny. I would I could have lived to see thee. But God's will be done. Oh.
Oh, merciful heaven, has he gone? Oh, so handsome and so young.
No, he has but fainted away. The pulse is exalted but present. There is some hope he will survive, at least as far as the inn.
And in truth, the inn was not now very distant, the coachman having sprung his team into a gallop to make up some of the lost time. At the inn, the innkeeper and one of the servant-maids were up and in readiness to attend the travellers.
Oh, no, Mr. Tellwells, no, you mustn't.
Oh, come, Betty. Just one small kiss. One kiss.
Oh, Mr. Tellwells. Mrs.
Tellwells is sound asleep in her bed, Betty. No one will know. Just one small kiss, you adorable creature.
Very well then, Mr. Tellwells. Just one, but no more, mind. Oh, Mr. Tellwells, no! No, you mustn't! Oh, heavens! There's the coach, Mr. Tellwells! Mr. Tellwells!
Oh, devil take it, just wait. Cover yourself, Betty, and attend to the fire. I must go to receive the company. Good morning, gentlemen. You are very welcome. This way. There's cold beef and a jorum of cider and hot at the fire. Dr. Cutler, you are well returned, Your Honour.
This is a poor foot passenger who was stripped and almost murdered. We found him by the roadside.
Good luck, the poor fellow. He was fortunate indeed that one of Your Honour's known compassion and good nature came by. Betty?
Betty. Yes, Mr.
Tellwells. Get up a bed for this poor, unfortunate creature at once. And once he's a bed, go to my chamber and fetch him.
The wench, being not so squeamish as the lady had been, carried Joseph to a bedroom with the aid of the coachman, and there washed his wounds and put him to bed. Then she made her way to her master's bedroom, where she believed her mistress to be still asleep.
Oh,
Towerhouse, Betty. Yes, madam.
Where's your master?
He's without, madam. He has sent me for a shirt to lend a poor naked man who hath been robbed and murdered.
Touch one if you dare, you slut. The old master's a pretty sort of man to take in naked vagabonds and clothe them with his own clothes. I should have no such doings.
But, madam...
Don't you but, madam, me. Go, send your master to me.
Yes, madam.
Mr. Towerhouse was reluctant to exchange the company of his guests for that of his wife. But in that house her word was stern law, and he duly presented himself at her bedside.
My dear...
What the devil do you mean by this, Mr. Towerhouse? Am I to buy shirts to lend to a scabby rascal?
My dear, this is a poor wretch that's robbed of all he had.
Well, here's his money to pay his reckoning. Why does not such a fellow go to an alehouse? I shall send him packing as soon as I'm up, I shall you.
My dear, common charity won't suffer you to do that.
Common charity, if not.
Oh.
Common charity teaches us to provide for ourselves and our families, and I and mine won't be ruined by your charity, I shall you.
Well, my dear, do as you will when you're up. You know I never contradict you.
No, if the devil was to contradict me, I'd make the house do up to hold him.
While this pleasant discourse between husband and wife continued, Betty provided a shirt from the hostler, who was one of her sweethearts, and put it on poor Joseph. Meanwhile, the coach departed along the London road, where it was shortly robbed by highwaymen, one of whom was dressed in livery, and halted the coach on the pretence that his master's carriage had overturned. At the inn, Dr. Cuttle, having taken his breakfast, bethought himself of the injured Joseph, and went up to examine him again.
Do you apprehend me to be still in danger, sir?
I do, very grave danger. I fear I can do very little for you as a surgeon, though I may be of some assistance as a lawyer.
How do you mean, sir?
To help you draw up your will. For if you have any worldly affairs to settle, you should do it as soon as possible. Lest... to speak as a surgeon, the malign concoction of your humour should cause a suscitation of your fever, and you should become incapable of writing a testament.
Alas, sir, since the robbery I have not one thing of any kind whatever which I may call my own. So you see, sir, there would be no purpose to my drawing up a will. But I should be infinitely grateful if I might have pens and paper to compose a letter.
Who to? To your parents?
Indeed, no, sir. To my beloved sister Pamela, whose virtuous example could alone enable me to withstand all the temptations of riches and beauty, and to preserve my virtue pure and chaste for the arms of my dear Fanny, if it hath pleased heaven that I should come to them. Oh, dearest Pamela, noblest of sisters!
Calm yourself, I beg. You will but inflame the fever. Here, I will leave you this sanative soporiferous draught.
And after giving Joseph the injunction that he should endeavour to prepare himself for another world, the surgeon left him and went down to acquaint Mr. and Mrs. Towerhouse of his condition.
It is as I feared, Mr. Towerhouse. He's very light-headed. He uttered nothing but to rave a rhapsody of nonsense about some Pamela, and is now completely delirious, or delirious, as the vulgar express it. There is scarce any hopes of his recovery.
It's a pretty kettle of fish you've brought upon us, Mr. Towerhouse. We're locked to have a funeral at our own expense.
My dear, I'm not to blame. He was brought here by the stagecoach. The doctor here brought him
Oh, Dr. Cuttle, it's to you that we owe his presence.
Not I, Mrs. Towerhouse. No, I was for leaving him where he lay. No, it was at the very earnest insistence of one of the other passengers. And besides, the coachman refused to carry him any further.
Now it happened that this conversation was overheard by a grave person who had rode into the inn in the course of the morning and, having called for a pipe of tobacco, had taken his place by the fireside. This gentleman discovered a great deal of emotion at the distress of the poor creature above stairs, whom he observed to be fallen not into the most compassionate hands. He joined the company and addressed the surgeon.
Pray, sir, this poor fellow,
What are his wounds?
What? Do you know anything of wounds?
I have a small smattering in surgery.
A smattering? I believe it is a smattering indeed, eh, Tawas?
Oh, you're a very dry fellow, Doctor.
I suppose, sir, you have travelled?
Oh, really, sir?
Oh, then you've practised in the hospitals, perhaps?
No, sir.
I'm not there either. When, sir, then, if I may be so bold to inquire, have you got your knowledge of surgery?
Sir, I do not pretend to much, but the little I know, I have some books.
Books? What, I suppose you have read Galen and Hippocrates. You would not be familiar with these works now, Wells, but thanks to my education, I have them both by heart and very seldom go without them both in my pocket.
They are pretty large books.
I believe I know they are better than you.
Doctor, if I knew half as much as you, I'd never wear an apron again.
Oh, the law, husband, Archie, oh, the law, he pegs.
Now, physics, sir. There are few men, though I say it, within 12 miles can better handle a fever than Etia curati morbo, eh? I suppose, brother, who understand Latin
somewhat
and Greek. A smattering, no doubt. Tom deaf, vomit, vominos, thalassita. Ah, but I have forgot these things.
Oh, no, no, you are him there, Doctor. You are him there.
The observant will, no doubt, have recognized the person of the grave gentleman, either from his manner of speaking or from certain hints or clues in what he spoke. It would indeed be no hard thing for us now to give you his name, but, having travelled thus far with us, you will know that such is not our method. Rather, we choose to leave the matter in the air and whisk you to the Lady Booby's townhouse in London, where Milady has just woken in a melancholy and pious temper.
Slip-slop. Slip-slop, come hither. Come hither, I pray.
Yes, madam, what is it now?
Slip-slop, I find the town begins to grow wearisome. I am resolved that we should return to the country immediately. There I shall devote myself to good works and to the improvement of the brutes. My honest neighbours, I would mean, rather. I fear grief for my dear husband has quite turned the pleasures of the town to ashes in my mouth. Prithee, how does one become a nun?
Grief? Pish! It is not grief that sends you flying into the country, madam, but your own folly in discharging...
Slip, stop! You are too pert. What, pray, do you mean by addressing me with such freedom?
Freedom? I don't know what you call freedom, madam. Servants have tongues as well as their mistresses.
Yes, and saucy ones, too. But I assure you, I shall bear no such impertinence. Unless you mend your manners, this house is no place for you.
Manners? I was never thought to want manners, nor modesty neither. And as for places, there are more places than one. Nor shall I feel ablated to keep silent.
Oh, no, Mrs. Slipsop, pray do not take offence. It is my grief that makes me perhaps a little choleric.
In truth, Lady Booby had begun to admire the new style of her waiting gentlewoman, and besides, was determined to submit to any insult from a servant rather than put to risk her reputation, upon which depended so many of the blessings of life, such as cards and the innocent pleasures of demolishing the reputations of others.
Also, she felt herself in great need of a confidant. Mrs. Slipslop, dear, dear friend, you are a woman of sensibility and understanding. In all honesty and in the strictest confidence, what is your opinion of the... I think you may know who I mean.
Not I, upon my word, madam.
I mean the young fellow. Sure, you are the dullest wretch.
Oh, la. I am indeed, madam. Yes, truly, madam, he is an accession. He's such a handsome fellow.
Is he? Oh, I think only of his virtues. Slips off such piety to his parents, such tender affection to his sister, such integrity in his friendship, such goodness.
To be sure, ma'am.
But, as he is, if he had 1,000 more good qualities, it must render a woman of fashion contemptible, even to be suspected of thinking of him. Yes, I should despise myself for such a thought.
To be sure, ma'am.
And why to be sure? Thou art always one's echo, Slipslop. Is he not more worthy of affection than a dirty country clown, though born of a family as old as the flood, or a little preeny beau of quality? Yet such, by the tyranny of custom, we must prefer. For we people of fashion are the slaves of custom, so we are.
Marry cannot, ma'am. If I was a woman of your ladyship's fortune and quality, I would be a slave to nobody.
Me, Slipflop? Me? No! I am speaking if a young woman of fashion who had seen nothing of the world should happen to like such a fellow. Me, indeed! I hope that does not imagine...
Now, madam, to be sure.
Me, indeed. No, Slipslop, all thoughts of men are over with me. I have lost a husband who... but if I should reflect, I should run mad. My future ease must depend upon forgetfulness. For the which reason, Slipslop, I would have you take a place in the public stagecoach tomorrow and return to Booby Hall to make all ready for my return.
Very well, madam. And, madam...
Yes, Slipslop.
Is there some hope that Joseph may have his place again?
That I will consider further. Now, leave me.
At the inn, the strange gentleman had very contentedly suffered the doctor to enjoy his victory, and having sufficiently sounded his depth, said to him...
Sir, I am thoroughly convinced of your great learning and abilities. And would be obliged if you would give me your opinion of the patient's case above stairs.
His case, sir? Why, his case is that of a...
What in heaven? Laidlaw! Laidlaw! Where's the devil's boy, Laidlaw? Are you all dead, Daddy?
Oh, come in, sir, come in. What is your honour's pleasure?
Mr. Towers, what's this, your honour? Can you not see the fellow's but a footman? And a mighty ragged and ill-favoured footman at that.
But a footman, you say, woman? But a footman? Do you not know whose livery this is?
No, no, I confess I do not.
That's as well. You are the mistress of the house, no doubt.
Indeed I am.
Well, know that the Duke of... But I'll not say. A certain great personage will shortly be passing this way with a large company. And I am sent there to command rooms and victuals for them all. But I fear this hovel will not suit...
Hovel?
Nay, stay, sir, stay. Will you drink something?
Why, that's more civil. I'll taste your brandy. Bring me pottle, landlord.
Oh, I will, sir.
You will excuse me, sir. Have you served your master long?
That I have, but not in this habit. I served him 10 years as a sergeant in the French wars.
Well, you have been a soldier.
Aye. God help me, I lived over long with the rattle of the drum and the smell of powder. Still, I sent a few Frenchmen to hell for His Majesty, God bless him. Come, a toast to the King. King George. Landlord, you scurvy devil, where's my brandy?
Come in, sir.
What think you of this affair at Carthagena, sergeant?
Sir, I don't like it. If I'd been there with my old master, we'd have done things otherwise, or died on the field.
Give me a hand, you're a man after my heart. Oh. What's a man's life when his country demands it? A man who won't sacrifice his life for his country deserves to be hanged, sir.
Oh, pray, do not use that expression, sir.
Tell me, sir, would you oblige us with the name of the gallant duke to whose household you belong?
I oblige you? Why the devil should I oblige you? Well, I'm damned if I will... Did I say Duke?
You did. What? I must tell you, you are lying. That is not the livery of any Duke, but of the late Sir Thomas Booby, all of whose household are known to me.
So that's the game, is it? Hold, all of you! Don't move, or you're dead and damned!
If you do not put that pistol down, I assure you, it is you that will be damned!
I beg you, do not provoke him, do not! He'll kill us all! Yeah. Don't shoot me, please! Please don't shoot, please!
Why?
No, no, Mr. Towers, no!
My bold landlord, so there's a spark in you, is there? Will I have another pistol for you? Oh. I fear to use either of them. For I tell you I was a soldier, and a sergeant too, and I've seen that much blood, a few drops more won't bother me. I recall it.
breathless narrative of his military adventures was cut short by the arrival of Betty the serving maid, who, descending the stairs with a stone pot of the chamber, had discharged it, together with the contents, full of the highwayman's head. The man was but stunned and somewhat put out. However, Parson Adams, for the grave gentleman was indeed our old friend Parson Adams, now leapt at the highwayman with an agility surprising in one of his huge frame. He struck him with a fist rather less than the knuckle of an ox, and seizing him with a wrist which Hercules would not have been ashamed of, quickly disarmed him.
No sooner was the man secured than Betty gave it as her opinion that the stolen livery he was wearing was that stripped from the unfortunate young man she had been attending.
At which Parson Adams desired her to take him upstairs, that he might discover which of Lady Ruby's household had fallen into this misfortune. And great was his distress when he discovered who indeed it was. My poor Joseph. Why are you not in London with your mistress?
Parson Adams. By all that's wonderful, how came you here? But first, how is my beloved Fanny?
Oh, she's in perfect health, Joseph, in perfect health. But pray, tell me, how came you here? What has occurred?
Since it would be impertinent to insert a discourse which chiefly turned on matters we have already discovered to you, we will simply remark that afterwards Joseph turned to other matters.
Mr. Adams, if I am to die, there's a thing which has been much troubling me.
We are all to die, Joseph, at some time. But
Mr. Adams, I know not if it is a sin, but if it is, I fear I shall die in the commission of it. And that is my regret at parting from my dear Fanny, whom I love as well as my heartstrings.
Truly, Joseph, any repining at the divine will is one of the greatest sins you can commit, and a dying man ought to forget all carnal affections and think of better things. Never fear, Joseph. I dare repine your... Who is there?
Mr. Cuttle entered the room. After a longish dissertation on the rules of evidence, he dressed Joseph's wounds and remarked,
"The imminent danger to the patient still persists, yet I begin to have hopes, which I impute to the sanity of soporiferous draught I prescribed, whose virtues may never be sufficiently extolled. Good day. I will visit you again in the morning."
Great indeed must be the virtues of that medicine if it has cured me, Mr. Adams. For the mere effluvia which escaped the cork must have done it. For there it lies in the window, unopened.
Be of good cheer, Joseph. Lately the surgeon desires to make a merit of curing you, and any fool may see the wounds in your head are by no means dangerous, and you have no fever.
Why, I'm right glad of that, Mr. Adams. But I do fear I may have some harm in my inside, for I feel something very odd in my stomach, though that may be because I have not eaten these 20 hours.
Why, for sure it is. But now command whatever viands you wish for. Here, I have 9 shillings and 3½ penny in my pocket, which you are welcome to use as you please.
Mr. Adams, you are the truest of friends, and I do feel I could eat something.
Betty was summoned, and great was her delight to find Joseph no longer at death's door.
Oh, Joseph! Oh! Does my heart go to see you looking better? Oh!
Betty!
We would like to demand some food for Joseph, Betty.
Oh, well, what will you have then, Joseph? Poached egg? Some chicken broth? Some rabbit?
Oh, Betty, I could eat all those, but what I do seem to have the greatest appetite for is a loin of mutton, boiled with caper sauce, cabbage and onions and turnips.
Betty, who was at length detached from Joseph's person, went off to order the meal, and Adams at last told Joseph of the purpose of the journey he was making to London, which was to try to publish 9 volumes of sermons.
Being encouraged, Joseph, by an advertisement lately set forth by a company of booksellers, which suggests I may expect a considerable sum for them.
So busy had been the morning that we are glad to grant that nothing remarkable should have occurred until evening, when Mr. Cuttle, arriving to help convey the thief before the justice, found a small accident had happened, which somewhat disconcerted him.
Escaped, Tullwise, escaped! What do you mean, escaped?
He was held here by the constable, Mr. Cuttle.
Was ever such a fool as my husband, Mr. Cuttle?
No.
To leave him in the custody of that drunken blockhead Tom Suckbribe? I want to know how he escaped.
In truth, Mr. Suckbribe, the constable, was not wholly free from suspicion. For it was his constant maxim that no wise man ever refused money. And besides, he was observed drinking ale with a man with a bandaged head who passed him several guineas. Howsoever that may be, after this the night passed comfortably enough for all our company, all save Lady Booby in London, whose troubled slumbers were so like those of the night previous as not to be worth portraying to you. Next morning, too, passed quietly, but in the afternoon, Mr. Adams became agitated that his small stock of money had been more than exhausted by the scoring for Joseph and himself, the stabling of his horse, and other expenses.
Mr. Adams was taking a cup of ale with the surgeon when he hit on what he believed to be a sure method to recruit it. Oh, Mr. Cuddle, it will oblige me to return home with Joseph. Mrs. Towers?
Your Honour.
Mrs. Towers, I wish to borrow 3 guineas, for which I can put ample security into your hands.
Ample security, Mr. Adams? Would that be a watch or a ring?
Something of greater worth than that, madam. Ooh. In my saddlebags are 9 manuscript volumes of sermons, any one of which, so a neighbouring clergyman assures me, is worth £10. One of these shall be my pledge.
Yes, Mr. Adams, I'm no judge of such kind of goods, and as for money, I do not believe we have so much in the household. That I must consult Mr. Towers. Excuse me, gentlemen.
I fear she will not furnish me, Mr. Cuttle.
Mr. Adams, the age has grown so wicked that scarcely anybody now reads sermons. For myself, I never travel without a volume of Tillotson's sermons in my pocket, and would as lief read him as a play that has been acted 20 times together.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear sermons compared to plays, sir. Surely you can't. What is this?
There is a term in rhetoric, which now eludes me, but is no doubt to be found in the works of one or other of the ancient sages, that describes the device we have just used, viz., to give you the climax of a tale before you have heard what led up to it. For Joseph was unwittingly the innocent cause of Betty's downfall. She had conceived such an extraordinary passion for him, and had behaved so immodestly, that he had been obliged to forcibly shut her out of his chamber, thanking heaven that a man's chastity is always within his power, and he cannot, like a poor weak woman, be ravished against his will. Her passion, like a mighty torrent, dammed in one course, had diverted itself into another channel, where it was more readily received. Mr. Towers and Betty had just achieved their bliss when, as the lawyers express it, they were taken in the manner by Mrs. Towers, who was to remind her husband of the event once or twice a day for the residue of his life. Which explained, we return to the main body of our tale.
Mr. Adams still had no notion of how he might meet his bill, and some time later was seeking the solace of a pipe of tobacco in the inn yard as the coach from London rolled in.
Mrs.
Ladies, gentlemen, please descend. It's a pleasure to bring you to...
Welcome all, welcome, fast welcome to my house. This way, this way.
Madam, thank you. I am confident... Parson Adams. Is it you?
Mrs. Slipslop. What brings you back from London?
By this fortunate accident, Mrs. Slipslop was able at once to lend Mr. Adams the means to pay his bills. And when she learned of Joseph's injuries, she insisted he be given a place in the coach at Lady Booby's charge. For, as she told the parson over supper,
Mr. Adams, I blame the old matter on my lady's coronation. There has been a strange alteration in her family since Sir Thomas's death. In all certainty...
A strange alteration indeed, Mrs. Slipslop. But I gather from certain hints dropped from Joseph.
Joseph has new hints.
But of what nature? I promise it would always remain a perfect secret with me, Mrs. Slipslop.
All of these things are no secrets to me, I assure you. For ever since the noise departure, she has behaved more like a mad woman than anything else. But Mr. Adams, let us discuss other matters. I would be honored, Mr. Adams, if I might peruke one of them volumes of sermons you intend to print.
Oh, the vanity of authors! Which of us is not susceptible to the flattery of such a request? And Mr. Adams at once went to his saddlebags, only to find they contained 3 shirts, a pair of shoes, and other necessaries, but not the sermons, for he had left all 9 volumes behind. And so he informed Mrs. Slipslop.
Pray allow me to send them on to you, Mr. Adams.
You are most kind, Mrs. Slipslop, but no. What would it avail me to tarry in the great city? Unless I had my discourses with me. No, I shall return to my cure. This disappointment may be intended for my good.
So, having made his farewells to Joseph, whom he left in Mrs. Slipslop's care, Mr. Adams departed at once towards the west. Not long afterwards, the coach, with Joseph and Mrs. Slipslop aboard, set off in the same direction. In the gathering dusk, it came up with a parson, who was striding briskly along, a crab stick in his hand.
Why, look, Mr. Slipslop, yonder is Parson Adams walking along.
Why, so he is, Joey. Oh, the parson was always a mighty walker.
But Mrs. Slipslop, he rode to the inn. He forgot his horse.
On my word, and so he hath. The surest Thomas he hath left him behind at the inn. I'll confirm him of it. Mr. Adams! Hi there! Mr. Adams! Hi!
Mr. Adams! Mr. Adams!
Is it you, Joseph? Ah! I'm going to die tonight, Paul. Can we come to this county?
Coachman, whip up, will you, and overtake that man. There's a shilling for you if you catch him. Mr. Adams!
Why, that's easily earned. Up you! Hey, come on, up!
And so the parson sailed off, and the faster the coachman drove, the faster he ran ahead, until the coachman eventually gave up the unequal chase.
There, boys, softly, softly. That'll take your balance. I lost it. I'd as soon chase after a 3 hours, so help me.
When the parson was a full 3 miles ahead of the coach, he came to a place where, by keeping to the extremest track to the right, it was just barely possible to miss one's way. This track did he keep, for Mr. Adams had a wonderful capacity in these matters, and he soon became lost. Yet, perhaps his course was ordered by Providence, for no sooner did he discover himself lost than he heard...
Pray, sir, pray, I beg you, unhand me!
Scream as much as you like, my dear. There's no one to hear you.
I'm coming!
Hey.
Unhand her!
will you? Jesus, come this carnal urge. Be warned, fellow! Now, be of good cheer, damsel. You are no longer in danger of your ravisher, who, I greatly fear, lies dead at my feet.
It's isn't it? Parson Adams!
Fanny Goodwill! Fanny!
In episode 2 of Joseph Andrews by Henry Fielding, dramatized in 4 episodes by John Scotney, Fielding was played by John Rye, Joseph by Cornelius Garrett, and Lady Booby by June Barry. Anne Jameson was Mrs. Slipslop, Peter Copley, Dr. Cuttle, Mary Wimbush, Mrs. Tauwaus, Ronald Herdman, Mr. Tauwaus, John Franklin Robbins, Parson Adams, Jane Leonard, Fanny, Ingrid Hafner, the lady in the coach, John Church, the coachman, and Sean Barrett, the second robber. Music was composed and directed by Vic Gammon. Joseph Andrews is directed in Bristol by Sean McLaughlin.